Well, it's wonderful to be back here and see the new palace-like structures. It's yellow with envy. I want to talk about cosmology event horizons and the S matrix. And the angle from which I'm coming is that we don't really know what quantum gravity should compute for us, right? We, a priori, it's very hard to figure out what the observables should be in that theory. And that's less embarrassing than it sounds because, for example, if you'd asked Einstein in 1905 or 6 what his theory of gravity that he was after should compute, he probably couldn't have told you yet that it was a metric tensor. And, I mean, there's a lot of insight in just figuring out that that's the particular object that you're trying to find an equation for. Right. So in a sense, that would be a big step towards understanding what kind of theory we need, would be just to understand what it should compute. So of course, we have string theory, and that's a theory of quantum gravity. And it computes things, so presumably those are the things we're after. But what string theory computes is essentially an S matrix or some close relative of an S matrix, say in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence. It computes, you know, correlation functions in a conformal field theory that can be interpreted in a very similar way. And what's common to those kinds of observables is that they have something to do with sitting on the outside of a spacetime that has a boundary and looking in. And integrating over everything what happens inside and just caring about what comes back out. So that's a clever way for string theory to sort of extract itself from all the confusions that we would run into if we tried to do cosmology or if we tried to be an observer that's inside a black hole approaching some space-like singularity. There are many kinds of space-times and situations we can envision where there is no boundary, or at least there's no causal contact with any boundary. And it's very hard to see how what we have so far discovered in string theory can deal with those situations. So it's as if string theory has kind of sidestepped the hard part of that question. That's not to say that it's a small achievement to have a quantum gravity theory in the context in which we do, but it seems that by independently asking this question, what should quantum gravity compute in highly dynamical backgrounds? We might actually learn something about what is yet to be discovered in string theory. What is this new breakthrough that might be needed to actually deal with such issues? And just to remind you about some of the problems that one encounters in cosmology, perhaps in a slightly more controlled environment than complete gravitational collapse. Let's just recall the Sitter space, the spacetime with a positive cosmological constant, maximally symmetric, which has often been held up as a sort of worst-case scenario among standard cosmologies for various different reasons, and so let me list them. One reason is that the Sitter space has an event horizon. And it's not just an event horizon somewhere in the space-time, like for a black hole, but it surrounds you. And so what this means is that if you thought of doing something that was analogous to measuring the outstate in the S-matrix formalism, you'd run into trouble because all these particles that you have at late times in the Sitter space, presumably most of them have crossed your event horizon. You have no way of causally actually collecting all of this information about what's coming out at a time when things are well separated. And of course, similarly, it's very hard to set up an experiment at early times. So this contrasts with the causal diagram for Minkowski space, where you can do all these things. You can always go to an early enough time so that you can set up things, and to a late enough time so that you can actually measure everything that comes out, a global outstate, in a causal fashion, and not miss anything. Okay, you can't do this here, but there are many other problems, okay, in the Sitter space. This one is one that has given rise to a bit of a folklore that I'm going to try to attack in this talk. The idea that somehow if you're in a cosmology with an event horizon, that's really bad for defining any kind of observables. And if it doesn't have an event horizon, you're home free. I think both of these statements are not true. Okay. But the sitter space is particularly bad. And I think the reason that it's particularly bad has to do with another bunch of obstructions to doing physics accurately. One is that in the sitter space, you have a finite maximum entropy, at least if you restrict to the part of the spacetime that any one observer can see. And that's not so hard to see. If you just sit here at, this is some r equals 0 in the sitter space, some observer's world line. All that you'll see at late times is this empty spacetime. All the matter will have crossed the horizon by then. This is the horizon. And you know what the entropy of that is. The entropy of empty de Sitter space is just the area of the horizon surrounding you. And by the generalized second law, that better be the largest it's ever been. So the entropy that you'll ever have is less than this maximum, which is related to roughly 1 over the value of the cosmological constant. And that means, for example, that you can't measure anything to arbitrary accuracy. That's immediately clear. Just try writing down a number with an arbitrary number of digits. You run out of bits. And of course, the problem in practice comes in at a much earlier stage. You can't build an arbitrarily elaborate apparatus because of the finiteness of this event horizon. You can't build arbitrarily large measuring apparatus. All these things that implicitly we have in mind when we give exact meaning to an S matrix, that you can take limits where experiments last arbitrarily long, things become arbitrarily well separated, all of those things you cannot do. Okay. Another reason why you're in trouble in the sitter space, which I'm going to argue is going to be less severe in other space times with an event horizon, is that you have a temperature. So this was shown by Gibbons and Hawking. It's very analogous to black hole radiation. There's a temperature of order 1 over the curvature radius of the sitter space that you perceive as an observer sitting here in the sitter space as coming from this horizon. Now, that means a typical quantum, if we happen to be living in the sitter space right now or approaching it, it has a wavelength of, you know, perhaps billions of light years. And so it's not a great disturbance. But if you wait long enough, it matters, right? You can't do this idealization where you over long times, you get into this more and more quiet environment where you can measure things to arbitrary accuracy. So there are really two problems that come from this temperature. One is slow erosion of any apparatus or any experiment that you make by this constant bombardment with these weak gravitons or photons. And there's also, if you wait long enough, some amplitude for being simply knocked out by some large fluctuation that very rarely comes out of the horizon with exponential suppression. The point is that whatever the probability for these things is, you might get hit by a big black hole, right? It's constant. So eventually it happens. Right? And so you can't do all these limits that we don't even talk about much when we talk about the S matrix. They're kind of implicit that we can take these arbitrarily long times.
Sorry.
Yes?
Even when you do experiments, you just build not infinitely big apparatus.
Sure.
Just
yeah.
You
yeah.
Don't wait for infinite amount of time. So the things we do in real, that's what all the
numbers. That's absolutely right. But the point is that we imagine that if we have a theory that predicts some outcome for scattering amplitudes to arbitrary accuracy, that we can at least imagine devising more and more expensive experiments that test these to arbitrary numbers of digits. You specify how many you want, and then you spend our tax dollars on actually measuring it to that accuracy. Okay. And actually, yeah, mostly ours, not rich people's. And so you can imagine that kind of limiting procedure. And it's clear that here you can. So it's very much a question of principle, not of practice. I'm not denying that the S matrix is an excellent observable in the context of SLAC or the LHC for all practical purposes. But you also see that there's a bigger conceptual question. Once we actually do look at the universe and we measure things like the cosmic microwave background, or whenever you look through a telescope, you start doing something that is really very different from what you do at SLAC. You're inside looking out. You're not outside looking in. So it's a very, you're a very small part of a large system that you're studying. Here in SLAC, it's exactly the other way around. Right. So all of these different effects, more than the event horizon, make De Sitter such a horrible place to do physics in. One part of my talk is going to be to argue that in other cosmologies with an event horizon, all of these problematic effects are absent, or at least their bad consequences are absent. Okay. On the other hand, sometimes people argue that because in a decelerating universe without an event horizon, the causal structure in the far future looks very similar to that of Minkowski space, that you don't have to, that at least for the outstate, you can do physics as if you were doing an S matrix, that you have some hope of kind of measuring the state that the universe is in. And there are probably a lot of different arguments, some of them semi-philosophical, like how can a part of a system measure another part of the system, that could be advanced against this. I'm just going to give you another one, perhaps, that you may not have heard. The upshot of all of that is going to be to really introduce a sort of third category that lies between this idealized S-matrix environment where we can do everything, really global observables and to arbitrary accuracy, and this De Sitter environment where we pretty much can't do anything. We can't even measure any local observables, say the mass of the electron, to arbitrary accuracy. I'm going to argue that there's a large class of cosmologies, essentially all of, I'm going to give you one parameter family, and De Sitter space is the only exception, where you can at least measure local quantities to arbitrary accuracy, or there are no obvious obstructions to doing that. But I'm going to argue that in all of these cosmologies, including the decelerating ones that don't have an event horizon, you have no hope of measuring some kind of global state, unless you assume a lot about that global state to start with. One thing that I'm going to completely leave out in this talk is what these exact observables that there is no obstruction to might actually be. Okay, that's a separate that's work in progress. So let me first. This is obviously a somewhat speculative area to work in, and to just narrow down the arena in which to investigate this. I'm going to focus in on a very special set of cosmologies, essentially a one-parameter family, namely the flat FRW universes with fixed equation of state. Usually this parameter is called W, the ratio of the pressure over the energy density. Now, this is not as horrible a restriction as it looks at first. What matters for this type of analysis is only the late time behavior of the universe, because you're asking, what can you do over arbitrarily long time scales? Right. So it doesn't matter if in the early universe there's a lot of mess going on. Who cares? It doesn't matter if we're the ones who are lucky enough to be able to observe things very well. So in particular, this restriction to a fixed equation of state is not really a restriction, because at late times, whatever dominates. I mean, the lowest value of W in the mix is going to dominate at late times. Right now, we're seeing the cosmological constant, which is -1, starting to take over. And well, flat FRW, it's particularly simple. Things wouldn't be that different if it was open. You basically still have an infinite amount of space. If it's closed, then it depends. If it's closed and recollapsing, that's a situation that's in a sense even worse than De Sitter space, then you definitely have a finite lifetime, and probably much shorter. If it's closed, it can also, if there's accelerating matter present, it can expand forever. And in that case, you're not going to know at late times that it was closed. That's like inflation, right? So this is really a relatively broad class of things to study. But of course, it's still, it's homogeneous and isotropic, and there could be a lot of other things you might want to study. But OK, this is going to be it. And let me just review briefly the causal structure of these spacetimes. The main distinction in this set is going to be between the accelerating and the decelerating ones. The accelerating ones will have an event horizon, the others don't. And we'll see that in the end, however, they both behave equally bad or well in terms of what you can actually do. So that would be the metric, and to get the causal structure, let's write it down in terms of conformal time, which shows that that this metric is conformal to Minkowski space, and so it's immediately clear that the Penrose diagram has to be a subset of the Minkowski space Penrose diagram. Okay, which subset? That depends on the range of this eta. Okay. So to find that range, we actually have to put in the matter content. So this is still completely general. So now we'll put in that we have matter with this fixed equation of state. And actually, I'm going to really work not with W, but with a more convenient variable, epsilon, which is basically the amount by which W is larger than a cosmological constant, than minus 1. Okay, so epsilon is 0 for De Sitter space. Epsilon is 1 for W equals minus 1/3, which is the dividing line between accelerating and decelerating. And epsilon is 3 for W equals 1, which is the stiffest equation of state that you can have and still be consistent with the dominant energy condition, which is a restriction I'm going to impose. So I'm going to consider only epsilon in this range. Okay. So if you do that, then you find that the scale factor is simply given by T to the power of 1 over epsilon. And for completeness, it will be useful later. Let me write down the density, which is given by 3 over 8 pi times epsilon t all squared. Okay. Now, this is not a good way of writing the solution for epsilon equals 0, which is De Sitter space. But I'm not so we already know what happens in De Sitter space, so I won't treat that separately. Okay, so once I go over to conformal time, can you read if I write down here? So this equation is important, really, mainly just to figure out the range here for eta, which is what we need to see what the Penrose diagram looks like. Notice that there are a lot of epsilon minus ones appearing, both in the prefactor and in the exponent, which means that both of these things change sign when epsilon crosses 1, which is this acceleration-deceleration divide. Okay. And so for epsilon greater than 1, you can see from this expression that A double dot is less than 0. Those are the decelerating universes. And that the range of eta is in the positive range, starting at zero. And so the Penrose diagram looks like this, with this down here being this the space-like singularity of the Big Bang. And then for epsilon less than one, well, that's the accelerating case. Those are the inflationary type universes. Whoops, zero, sorry. And in that case, you see that the conformal time runs between minus infinity and zero. I really shouldn't write an equal sign. And in that case, well, the Big Bang looks like a null singularity, though curvatures become Planckian already on some space-like singularity right here. So we shouldn't take that too seriously. The main point to notice here is that there is clearly a future event horizon, which you can read off at eta plus r equals zero, this line. Okay. An observer sitting here at r equals zero can receive signals only from this region and not from out here. Okay, so this is very similar to De Sitter space. Not too surprisingly, since the equation of state is very similar. So this was actually first pointed out by Hellman, Kelleher, and Susskind, and also by Fischler et al., as an argument that if the current acceleration that we're seeing, if that turns out to be, so these things are called quintessence, right? They have a name. If that turns out to be quintessence and not a fixed cosmological constant, so that we're asymptoting to this type of universe rather than De Sitter space, they said that's still a problem for string theory, because string theory only knows how to compute an S matrix. And if there's an event horizon, an S matrix doesn't make any sense. Okay, so basically, we're in trouble no matter what. That was the upshot. Now, you could take my talk as simply saying we were in trouble no matter what even before we discovered acceleration. this is a very good observation. There is an event horizon in these spacetimes. I'm just going to argue that whether or not there is an event horizon actually makes very little difference. In these types of universes, things are going to be better than in De Sitter space. We can probably define some exact observables. But in none of the universes, accelerating or decelerating, is there any hope of making sense of any global observable that would be analogous to an S matrix. So let me sort of put down the scoreboard here. That's what I want to argue for. So I want to say, no, there are not going to be any S matrix-like observables, even though the Penrose diagram, at least in the future part, looks suggestive of that sort of thing. And then there's certainly the correct observation that the event horizon here prevents you from defining global observables. But it would be incorrect to say things are as bad as De Sitter space because of this event horizon. In De Sitter space, we had no exact observables at all, global or not. And I'm going to argue that that doesn't go through. Okay, there's no obvious obstruction, even though there will be some thermal effects. They're just not as pernicious here.
What's the philosophy here? This doesn't tell us anything about the universe we live in.
Sorry?
How does this relate to the universe we live in and its future cosmology? I mean,
it could be
De Sitter, and so we don't have exact observables.
Yeah, that's right.
Do we have to have them?
Good. So you can take different interpretations. One is to say, okay, I believe that somehow physics should be nice to us. There should be some exact observables that are going to be predicted and that are measurable. And therefore, I believe that we're not going to be in exact De Sitter space. It better be something different.
You have a theory that has an exact Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
And the exact Hamiltonian puts you into sitter space, so there's no exact observables, even though it's an exact theory.
Yeah, but you might find that unattractive as a theory, just because it does something that we don't really want a theory to do. It predicts all these things that nobody can measure. It's a logical possibility. So, but I'm mainly okay. What I really think we should be doing is we should be trying to understand what might be the sort of approximate observables that we actually do go out and measure in an experiment. What are the ones that we're going to be able to, so that, you know, you don't have to worry about whether or not there's de Sitter space. There are clearly black holes. You can jump into a black hole. And then you have to worry about what physics does for you there. And it's clear there won't be any exact observables anymore. And so,
if I live in the constant state that I'm made of protons and protons decay, that means there's no exact observables because I'll only be around a finite period of time. But
That's right. But
that's not a problem principle for physics. It's just
The point is that you might be able to build structures out of things other than protons that don't decay, right? That there's some limiting procedure that you can take. I don't think we live in Minkowski space. I really think that the S matrix is just, I really think we need to come to grips with the idea that we need sort of fuzzy observables, imprecise things. But I find that too hard. So as an intermediate step, I find it interesting to ask, are there environments in which I can look for something that's not as nice as the S matrix, but in which I'm not faced with a whole blow of all of the problems at once, like in de Sitter space. And so that's really where I'm trying to go with this. I'm trying to argue that there is a large set of cosmologies in which I might be able to separate problems and take them one at a time, maybe look for the existence of at least some exact observables, because I find it too hard to look for the completely general observable that you probably want. So as an example, imagine measuring the mass of the electron to arbitrary accuracy. So in de Sitter space, I can't do that. In Minkowski space, I can do that, assuming that I have some apparatus available.
I want to think about this in terms of field theory in these backlog space times, because then there are exact observables which are fields, and you can calculate transitions between them, even if we're in the presence of a thermal bath.
It seems to me that if you're in the presence of a thermal bath, then there's some things that you won't be able to measure. I mean, there's a background noise. Right.
Is the issue of whether there's enough space to build some apparatus to measure?
Well, in de Sitter space, there's various issues. One is that. One is the lack of space. One is the lack of time. And one is this background noise that keeps, you know, wiggling things around and introducing some unpredictable thing that you can't get rid of by just taking things to be larger and larger and lasting longer and longer.
So what is the, for example, let's suppose we have field theory in this room, which is a thermal bath, and so we have field operators, which are emission operators, and in principle we can calculate some of the transition probabilities between one set of fields and one region, even if the state is thermal, that is, we can know exactly what the state is. So I think you would call those field operators not exact observables.
Right. Keep in mind the time scales that I'm talking about here. So if you're really in a thermal bath with finite entropy.
We are.
Yeah, we are in a thermal bath. But we don't usually worry about this problem because, for example, the time scale for this kind of effect is related to the recurrence time scale in a finite system. And so it's exponentially large. No, it's e to the some enormous number, e to the entropy of the system, right? So for our, it would be absolutely enormous. But over that system, you and your apparatus and everything you're trying to do by that's supposed to measure these transition rates are going to be completely wiped out. You will have cycled around the phase space and disintegrated. So that. It's a problem of principle that only kicks in on on exponentially large timescales that we usually don't worry about.
Would it be fair to say the problem is not with the field theory, which does supply exact answers to all those questions, including the knockout, but with some sort of measurement theory, that would be to construct apparatus that actually carries out the measures, the predictions? Would that be fair?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. No, I mean, that's right. You can obviously put you can write down a theory that gives you exact predictions if you switch off gravity at least. No, the problem is if you take seriously the idea that the things that your theory predicts ought to be measurable to the same degree of accuracy that they're predicted, then there's a tension. Is that?
But it's crucial for you that you're turning on gravity, right? That you're not just talking about field theory.
Really? I missed that. So, okay.
I mean, that has been what I have been assuming, but maybe. Because.
Well, maybe that will become clearer as I go on. So actually, in almost every part of the story, gravity does come into the argument.
Just because of the usual thing that you don't have local observables in gravity. Local fields would not be.
Yeah, so that's an obstruction to just trying to go local and forgetting about, yeah.
But I gather that's an additional, am I correct, that's an additional obstruction, even if we do a curved background space-time, say, the citizens, and there would be one further obstruction beyond gravity, prior.
Well, maybe I really should go on, because I think both of the main obstructions to defining global observables all of the obstructions I think are linked in one way or another with gravity. I mean, if you just think of the De Sitter space, what produces this thermal radiation you could call it a quantum field theory and curved space-time effect. I take it. Yeah. So maybe you want to think about that. So my goal in the rest of this talk is basically to try to make these points. Okay. And I think we'll learn maybe a little bit of there'll be some things that might be of independent interest on the way. But this is really the motivation that brought me to it. So let me start with a point that's relatively simple to make, and there are probably many other ways of making it, which is this point that by S matrix, like, I mean global. So is there a way of observing some kind of global out state in a decelerating universe where if I wait long enough, I see more and more and more? So in a sense, I can get access to larger and larger parts of the universe, unlike in the cases with an event horizon. Does that mean that I can do something like what I did here with the S matrix? I can really, if I have patience, get an arbitrary amount of information about what state the universe is in. And I'm going to argue that you can't. And to make that argument, the only thing I really need is a nice little theorem. So let me write this down. No global observations in flat FRW. And I'm going to treat only the case of decelerating universes, because it's obvious in accelerating cases you can't make global observations. So there's a nice theorem by Page, which people were interested in the context of black hole evaporation, whether or not it's a unitary process. And what he proved is the following thing. It's actually very general. Suppose you have some system with n degrees of freedom. Here there are 12. Let's suppose they're sort of spin-like. Doesn't really matter. Okay. And suppose that this system is in a pure quantum state. Okay. But it's in what's called a typical pure quantum state. In other words, you sort of average over the entire Hilbert space. You don't, it's not hard to see that a typical pure quantum state is one in which all of these spins are completely entangled. Right? It's very atypical for these things to factorize. Okay. So if you have the system in that quantum state, and now you make a measurement on a part of the system, and you ask yourself, how much information do you get about which state it's in? So if you measured the whole system, then you would see that it's in a pure state. In other words, the entropy would be zero, and the amount of information, is defined to be the number of degrees of freedom minus the entropy that you actually measure. In other words, if the entropy is zero, then you know exactly which state it's in, so you've read out all of the information. The information is n. Is there?
Well, I understood on page 7. Now I'm confused, because how could you ever make a measurement that tells you that the system is in a pure state? I don't think you can.
Yeah, I was wondering the same thing. You measure observables. You don't measure the state. Right? You can't measure the state. You have to measure a quantity and get some possible.
Well, good. So I assume that what you do is you measure. Okay. You do the usual thing. You prepare. You prepare the thing, you know, a gazillion times, and you repeat the experiment as many times as you need to.
You can repeat it.
Yeah. I'm allowing you to repeat it. Yeah, right. But that way we would never know if the S matrix is unitary. Yeah. So what he observed is that if you measure less than half of the system. So here you might think that you get about 4 bits of information doing this, but actually you get none at all. Okay, you only start getting any information once you measure at least half of the system. So in other words, if you measure these 4 bits, they're likely to be completely thermal. Okay, and that's not so hard to understand. If you measure less than half of the system, you can think to a good approximation as the other half as being a heat bath acting on this part that you're measuring. And so, you know, it's not surprising that it looks thermal. But the upshot is, okay, we have to measure at least half of the system to have any idea about what state it's in. Okay. And by the way, the non-repeatability in cosmology is, of course, another obstruction. People have worried about this, and you've worried about it much more than I have. This is simply a different line of argument. So here's a situation in which we have a finite system, and measuring less than half, we're already in trouble. Now let's look. Yeah.
Could you say more about the theorem?
Let me write down the.
I mean, you have a pure state density matrix. You traced over all of these other states or something. I don't see why you're left with no information.
Well, what does information mean? It means that after measuring some part of the system, I was able to narrow down which pure state it might be in to at least some subset of the Hilbert space. Okay, that, right. If I encode information in a quantum system and I want to read it back out, what I do is read out which quantum state is it in. Right. Partial information means reading out at least which part of the Hilbert space is it in. Can I narrow it down a little bit? If I measure these 4 spins and they're completely thermal, then I have absolutely no idea what state the total system is in. Maybe we can discuss this
afterwards. There's some assumption that the state of the whole thing is typical.
It's typical. Yeah, that's an important assumption. And I think, and I want to come back to this assumption after applying this to cosmology. So that I think that that's an interesting, that's obviously the assumption to be worried about or to take some lessons from.
But you have a density matrix for that subsystem. You can calculate, as usual, trace row log row, you'll get something.
Yeah, I will get an entropy that is, basically, I will get the entropy that's as large as the number of degrees of freedom that I've measured. That means it's the maximum entropy. It's completely thermal.
Why do you still have that information is contained in correlations between the different spins?
Yes.
And you only start seeing those correlations when you've measured half of the spins.
That's right.
Or more.
Yeah, that's another way of thinking about this. Yeah.
Yeah. Why? Something like that.
Yes.
Is there a weak interaction assumed here? Because, I mean, can I think about this system as a proton and subsystem as a quark inside a proton?
There's nothing assumed about interactions except that the interactions have have been around long enough to entangle the system. I mean,
can you measure the state of a quark inside a proton?
Can you measure? Well, that's a different problem, right? This is a completely abstract mathematical argument. It assumes nothing about the nature of the system. Okay, and this is a theorem, so I should move on, because you can just look it up. You can attack me for other things, but you can't, you know, the pay. So this is
direct all letters to Dominic.
That's right. He will be very happy to discuss this with you. And all I want to do is take Page's beautiful work and abuse it for a fishy application to cosmology, in which I will do the following thing. Let me give you a large view of. Actually, erase this. Give you a large view of the FRW universe. Okay. So here is a flat Euclidean space-like slice. Okay. This would be sky plus. This is why it's so similar to Minkowski space. But there are very important differences to Minkowski space. And the one that's very obvious to notice in that is another reason why you might worry about the existence of an S matrix is, of course, that the lower half is missing. But maybe there's some theory that will predict a unique instate. In fact, at least one person in this room has worked very hard on such theories. And so maybe we should leave that, you know, that question aside. There might be a unique instate that's simply predicted, and then we go about measuring it and confirming that prediction. So what I want to focus on is a different obstruction, which is that, in fact, this Penrose diagram is slightly misleading. There's a huge difference between this corner here in cosmology and that same corner in Minkowski space. And the difference is that matter stops somewhere in Minkowski in asymptotically flat space. That's pretty much the definition of asymptotically flat, that the density of matter drops off rapidly enough. And in simple definitions, you simply say that you can go outside some sphere, and then there's nothing there anymore. And that's what enables you to wait long enough and eventually make an observation on the entire system. Right? See everything that's there that you're interested in. That's what we do in the S matrix. Here, if there are particles homogeneously distributed through the spacetime because of the conformal factor, they kind of pile up here near this corner. And there's an infinite number in any neighborhood of the spatial infinity. So what this means is that, yeah, it's very nice. I can measure these particles if I wait very long, and if I wait longer, I can measure more of them. But at all times, no matter how long I wait, I'm going to have measured some finite number of particles and their state, and I will have missed an infinite number of particles. Okay, that's the limit. So that's the way to think about this limit. The point is not that any given particle can eventually be seen if you wait long enough. The point is that when you've done that, there's still an infinite number to go. Okay. So this is significantly worse than the situation. It's not just less than half, it's an infinitely small fraction that you're seeing. So this gives us some hint, and that's actually something that I'm thinking about right now with Lenny Susskind and Ben Freifogel, his student. This gives us some hint about what kind of things we might have to assume about the initial state if we wanted to have the property of being verifiable. Right, so you need things to cluster in some way. You need there to be many copies of the same information, and you need them to cluster and for this information to fall off as you get to larger and larger distances, so that asymptotically you get more and more of it. So in other words, you need the state of the universe to be a very special state, and that's really the key assumption here. And so maybe that's one hint at a direction that can be further explored. But for the purposes of this talk, all I wanted to say is that this naive idea that because this sort of looks like there's no event horizon and it's a bit like Minkowski space, you can deal with things as if there was an S matrix outstate. I think it doesn't work here any more than it does in spacetimes with an event horizon. There's some, unless you make much, much stronger assumptions. So now I want to, this is sort of the bad news. Now I want to turn to the good news, which is that if you do have an event horizon, unless you're actually in the sitter space, things are a lot better than what I've written down here. And let me go through that very quickly. So somehow, I'm just going to leave all of this. Is that? So I'll spare you the metric of the sitter space and simply remind you that there is an event horizon at a value of the radius equal to capital R, which I'm going to define to be the square root of 3 over lambda, where lambda is the cosmological constant. That's the size of the sphere around you and that swallows everything you throw into it and that you can't get anything out of. And this analogy with the classical properties of black holes carries over, as Gibbons and Hawking showed. There's a temperature in that space-time given, as usual, by the surface gravity over 2 pi. So it works out to be 1 over 2 pi times this radius. And correspondingly, there is an entropy, as there should be by the first law of thermodynamics, and also by the second law, because you want something to make up for the lost entropy of any matter that you've thrown across that horizon. And that's going to be the area of that event horizon, which happens to increase when you throw something across it. Okay. And what I've written down here is the value of the area in the case of empty de Sitter space, which is the largest possible value. You can check explicitly that the first law holds. In other words, if you throw a small test mass across the horizon, then the temperature and entropy change in just the way prescribed by the first law. You can calculate that by working out how much the area changes as a response to that energy. Okay. So just to review what all these problems are, well, the finite maximum entropy comes from the fact that you can't access that this really is the maximal entropy. That's empty de Sitter space. It doesn't get any higher than that. This temperature, well, first of all, there's erosion. Why is there erosion? Well, there are these weak Hawking quanta that keep bombarding you. And they're a fixed energy, and they come at a fixed rate. In other words, you don't get a break. They don't drop off in some way. So there's an infinite number of them that hits you. The effects pile up. Yes?
If we build ourselves a big shell, right, so trying to defend against this Hawking radiation, because there's some probability we'll create a Hawking quantum inside, but do we reduce the intensities of this radiation if we build a big wall?
Not on the time scales that we're interested in, because your big wall is going to be dismantled. And then there's the issue of gravitons, which you can't shield against. Not on these exponentially long time scales, you know, where matter is liquid and where it's a different scenario from any of the practical ones that we might actually be worried about.
Lord Payne said, in the long run, we're all dead.
That's right. I should have just said that at the beginning of the talk. But actually, no, I'm trying to have a more positive message. That's only in the sitter space.
Well, he was arguing not to worry, so.
Oh, I see. All right, so this is basically to do with an infinite number of fixed energy quanta. So that's what I'm going to test for in these non-de Sitter accelerating universes. And this knockout effect has to do with the fact that the probability, say, for a large black hole to be spontaneously produced by this hot horizon might be exponentially suppressed, but it's constant. That's all that matters. All right, so the probability for some large object of intrinsic entropy S is suppressed roughly by this factor of its energy over the temperature of the sitter space. That tends to be a lot, but it's constant. Okay, so eventually it happens. Okay. So now let's turn to this Q space, to this quintessence universes. Sorry for jumping back and forth, but I'm going to need these formulas. I have very little time. So what we're going to have to do is thermodynamics in Q-space. And that's sort of a thing worth sorting out in any case. What you expect is at least for very small values of epsilon, in other words, if we're very close to W equals minus 1, to the Sitter space, that this should be like an adiabatic variation of the cosmological constant of the Sitter space. So things should behave as if you were in the Sitter space with a very slowly changing cosmological constant. And it's in that limit that what I'm going to write down is going to be accurate, though I expect that at least qualitatively, the conclusions are going to be valid for probably most of the range of accelerating universes. But the approximation I'm going to use is that epsilon is very small. So we're very close to the Sitter space. It's going to take you a while to notice that the cosmological constant is actually decreasing. Okay. So then you notice, you can simply figure out what is the horizon. I'm going to use the apparent horizon in this context. I could work with the event horizon, but I'm going to show you in a minute that they're pretty much identical still. Now, the apparent horizon is in all FRW universes given by this formula, and that works out to be epsilon times t here, as you can see from that. Okay, so you see that the apparent horizon increases linearly with time, unlike in the Sitter space, where of course it sits at fixed radius, but at an extremely small rate if epsilon is less than 1. Okay. The Hubble time in any flat FRW universe is the same thing as the apparent horizon. And so we can check quickly that over one Hubble time, the apparent horizon changes relatively by a very small amount, namely epsilon, which is a justification of our adiabatic approximation. Okay. The other thing that you can check is that it doesn't matter much whether we're going to base our temperature and other thermodynamic aspects on the apparent or the event horizon. They differ by almost nothing. Okay. So I'm going to describe the thermodynamics, therefore, by a time-dependent temperature given by 1 over 2 pi times whatever the current value of that apparent horizon radius is. Okay. And so you see that that temperature, and this is of course crucial, drops off inversely with time. Okay. So there's still thermal effects, but we'll see in a minute that this drop off is fast enough to make them not very damaging. Okay. And similarly, the entropy is going to be given by a quarter of the current apparent horizon radius. And you see that this diverges. So what's happening is the box that you live in becomes arbitrarily large if you wait long enough. So you don't have to worry about, it's immediately clear that you don't have to worry about some in principle obstruction to having arbitrarily large apparatuses or some fundamental limit on the entropy there. So that's already gone, though you might worry about where you get the matter from, and that's something I'll address at the end of the talk. So now the question is, do we still have erosion and knockout effects? And that's actually very easy to see that we don't. So this erosion had to do with having an infinite number of quanta, each of which had a fixed energy. Now, in these universes, first of all, the rate at which these quanta are produced, that time scale is set by Ra. So the rate is 1 over Ra. That goes down linear, like 1 over time then. And the energy of the quanta, well, that's the temperature. It also goes goes down like 1 over Ra. Okay. So when you integrate that over all times, then the amount of energy that you're bombarded by is given roughly by 1 over epsilon times the next quantum that's about to hit you. So it's only parametrically larger than say, a billion light year graviton, which is not very damaging. So you really have nothing to fear from this radiation. The energy that it transmits to your system is completely negligible. It doesn't build up. Similarly for the knockout, so what if you specify what is the probability that I'll be hit by a system of energy E if I wait long enough? Well, you have to worry a little bit about what is the intrinsic entropy that enhances this probability of a system of energy E. But presumably it's not much larger than a thermal gas of that energy whose entropy is ER to the 3/4 by the usual entropy and energy relation to the temperature. Okay. And this E over T is also, well, just by the formula for T, it's basically ER, well, times 2 pi. Okay. So both of these things depend on ER. So if you're holding E fixed, you're asking for the probability to produce some large fluctuation of energy E. What's happening is the probability for that is no longer constant because R is becoming larger and larger, and this term is more important than that term for any system with more than one quantum in it. Okay. So the exponential, the exponent actually, is negative, and its magnitude grows linearly with time, so that the integral of that over all times is completely negligible. Right, it's a typical cutoff that you get when. Okay, so that tells you that there's no problem with erosion and there is no problem with a knockout in these universes. And the nice thing is that the universe, the weakness of the drop-off of the temperature in these universes is just right, so that you don't produce these large fluctuations with any reasonable probability, but at the same time, it's large enough to produce arbitrarily complex systems. The problem that you might worry about is that while there is no absolute entropy bound that would prevent you from sticking an arbitrarily large system into the universe, you still might worry where all that entropy is supposed to come from. If we're about to enter a quintessence phase, then the matter that we see now is all the matter that's ever, by just classical flow, going to be accessible to us, plus or minus a few billion light years. So that's it, right? We don't have that much to work with. There might be a lot of room in the far future, but there's not going to be anything to fill it. Right? But the nice thing is that if you ask a different question, what is the probability that some extremely complex system of some entropy S is eventually going to just fluctuate out of the horizon? That probability is actually fixed. Because remember, this is the entropy. The point is that the entropy is a function precisely of the product ER. So you get in the exponent no factors of R once you fix the entropy and eliminate the other variables. And so this is a constant. Okay. The reason why that's possible is that if you fix the energy, well, then there's a problem that the temperature is lower and lower and it becomes less and less likely to produce such an energetic object. But if you fix the entropy, the box in which you're waiting for that thing to happen is becoming larger and larger. And so the quanta that are needed to produce a system of very high entropy are cheaper and cheaper. They're lighter and lighter. That's why it's possible for this probability to diverge at late times, while at the same time this probability being completely negligible. So that's a nice thing that happens in these universes that I think didn't have to happen, and that suggests that maybe there really is something to the idea of trying to look for some exact observables that can be defined there at over extremely long time scales. That's all I had to say.
If I could go back to the Sitter case, I mean, you know, use of this word information is a bit funny because the picture that you describe of the thermal environment, finite horizon, was based on the assumption that there was a unique global state. the hard of fucking state.
That's generic.
If you got to that, it's by assuming a certain state for the center states. And then when you trace over behind the horizon, you get this thermal distribution. But it was in a pure state.
Well, that's one way of thinking about it. So there you treat the De Sitter space globally, and you put it globally into a pure state, and then that's one way of getting the apparent thermal state in there. But so I'm not sure. So where are you going with that? What's
there's no information there is a little funny because in fact globally the entropy is zero.
Well, but you can't measure anything global. I mean, I don't think I emphasize that there's
some measure, although. Yeah. It's not so clear you can't measure something.
But I didn't say anything about how much information. I mean, the point that I wanted to make about the Sitter space is that the actual entropy in the space-time is bounded by the area of the cosmological horizon. That's really the key point for this argument.
He's saying in effect that there's an inevitable coarse grain if you just restrict yourself inside the horizon.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think there's a contradiction. I mean. If you're saying the entropy is actually zero, that doesn't contradict my statement that it's less than 3 pi over lambda.
But the idea that there's no information globally is not so clear.
So the point about the information that you, globally that I made was actually in the context of FRW universes where you do have an infinite amount of matter. Here you don't have an infinite amount of matter, and so the arguments I gave there would not immediately apply to here. So it's actually a very different situation. Entropy is finite. Yes?
So I'm a little bit confused about what the conclusion is. Let's suppose we agree with everything you said.
Yeah. Well, that's up to you. I think one thing that I'm taking away from this for my own research is I'm interested in looking at some FRW universes where one can define some observables and asking, well, what might they be? So, my favorite model for what this dark energy is out there is that it's a metastable vacuum that really is an exact cosmological constant, well, until it decays. And then when it decays, a plausible scenario of how it decays is that it decays to zero cosmological constant, which basically gives you an open FRW universe, very similar to these flat decelerating FRW universes, but a bit nicer because at late times curvature dominates, and so you don't have any growth of perturbations. So that's a context in which one, I think, can start looking for what these observables might actually be.
But is it?
As I said, I think it is important to make progress on that question because I think we need to understand what are the observables in quantum gravity, and I see this as a small step that is not as ambitious as trying to understand what might be fuzzy local observables that you can define in the context of gravity, something that's a little bit more similar to what we know how to do than that really hard question.
You're not suggesting we give up physics because...
Oh, on the contrary. No, not at all.
We have to sort of put some limitation on what kind of measure you have.
No, I see this as a stepping stone towards understanding what the kind of observables are going to be that we need when we're really in trouble, like when we're inside a black hole or in other kinds of collapsing situations. I think there's going to be physics there, and I'd like to eventually understand the language in which it's going to describe things.
The observable that you're correlators, the correlator, these kinds of things, really seem like the right things to talk about our own everyday experience, mm-hmm. correlation between a temperature and a field, between you standing there and the air shaking.
Yeah.
That's just outside the scope of all of this. These are not exact things.
They're not exact things. Yeah. So
they're useful things.
That's right. So, but are you? I mean, the question is.
And then they would exist really independent of these global considerations.
The hope is that eventually you give you will give, you know, a meaning to these kind of things that is compatible with quantum gravity, with all the gravitational fluctuations that prevent you from making those things exact right now.
String theory would probably be easier. I mean, because in gravity, you can define integrals of root g times this field and that field.
Well, I mean, without string, no, I think without string theory, the problem is much bigger because you don't have a quantum theory.
Right, but the observable, I mean, the string theory has its own issues with observables beyond quantum gravity.
I don't think it gets better. I mean, at least in string theory, in the backgrounds that it knows how to deal with, it gives you, you know, a precise answer of what the observables are. I see it the other way around. We first, you know, maybe this is something that's going to help us figure out what the missing ingredients are that are going to allow us to extend quantum gravity into these kind of backgrounds.
One actually can write down formal expressions along the lines that you talk about, and you've been trying to make sense of them.
In gravity.
I have a quick question. Thank you. So, I think one problem in the theory of gravity is to define gauging line of the servo. And to do that, I think the only way is to go to the boundary of the space time. As far as I see,
That's the current state of the art. What if you don't have a boundary?
Right. That's not right. These conditionals, I think, one can define without going to the boundary.
You can define gauge invariant quantities without going.
Yeah. The point gauge transformations in gravity are diffeos in general relativity. And so, if you want to come up with appropriate diffeomorphism invariant statements, like a conditional probability for something to happen if something else happens, where you don't refer to explicit coordinates. That's the kind of animal you're looking at. You can define something different variant, at least formally speaking, that way.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker.
Thank you.